From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Joelle Hajboutros.
And I'm Dylan Okabe-Jowdat.
This week on War News Radio, Changing Perspectives.
First, we hear from an expert about urban gun violence.
Next, we present our editorial segment, Filibustered.
Finally, we talk to Ukrainian citizens about the future of the country.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, announced recently that Russian troops are prepared to overtake the Ukraine between 3 and 5 days. After expressing growing concern over the threat of 40,000 Russian troops stationed on the Ukrainian border, NATO officials have decided to suspend most activities with Russia, including a counter-narcotics training program in Afghanistan. NATO has reassured its Eastern European members that it would strengthen forces in the region, but has stopped short of calls to base more forces there. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen announced that the organization sees diplomatic dialogue as the next step, but is, quote, very determined to provide effective defense and protection of our allies.
3 bombs exploded outside of Cairo University this week, killing a police officer and injuring 5 security guards. Although the perpetrator of the attacks has yet to be identified, government officials noted that the bombs primarily targeted security forces and riot police. Violence on college campuses has risen in recent months as a result of demonstrations opposing the coup that ousted former President Mohamed Morsi. In February, the interim government authorized the Egyptian military to enter universities across the country to subdue protests. Analysts say violence against security forces will only escalate in the weeks leading up to the May election, in which General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is expected to win by a landslide.
United States Secretary of State John Kerry canceled a scheduled conference with Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas earlier this week after Abbas formally submitted applications for 15 United Nations treaties and protocols concerning the rights of women, children, and the disabled, as well as civilians during wartime. The U.S. and Israel both condemned Abbas's action as a breach of contract and a threat to ongoing peace negotiations. Abbas justified his actions by claiming that Israel did not follow through with its agreement to release the last group of Palestinian prisoners by March 29th. Peace efforts have been further damaged by the Israeli government's declared plans to develop Gilo, a part of Jerusalem captured in the 1967 war and claimed by Palestinians for a future state. The announcement coincides with U.S. attempts to maintain Israel's interest in the faltering peace talks by considering the release of Jonathan Pollard, a former U.S. Navy intelligence analyst sentenced to life in prison in 1985 for spying for Israel.
Over 620 people were arrested in Kenya this week following bomb attacks in the capital city of Nairobi. 6 people were killed in the bombings, which occurred in Eastleigh, a primarily Somali neighborhood. The blasts were the latest in a series of attacks and mass arrests that began in 2011 after Kenya sent troops to Somalia to battle Al-Shabaab, an Al-Qaeda affiliate. No group has taken responsibility for the attacks, although at least 200 of those arrested are thought to be sympathizers of Al-Shabaab. Most of the individuals arrested, however, were held on charges of staying in Kenya without proper documentation, and the Kenyan government has ordered all Somali refugees to move into designated camps in an attempt to prevent future attacks.
Former Pakistani military leader Parvez Musharraf escaped a bomb blast believed to be an attempt on his life. Earlier this week, Musharraf was charged with 5 counts of treason by a special court over alleged constitutional violations during his time in office. Since his return to Pakistan in 2013, he has been accused of several crimes linked to his suspension of the constitution and imposition of emergency rule in 2007. Although he pled not guilty, Musharraf could face the death penalty if convicted. One of Pakistan's longest-serving rulers, Musharraf has survived numerous assassination attempts and has also been the target of threats from the Taliban.
Chad declared plans this week to withdraw its peacekeeping troops from the Central African Republic. Chad, which has one of the strongest militaries in the region, previously contributed approximately 850 soldiers to the 6,000 total African Union forces. The announcement came in the wake of allegations that Chadian forces had sided with the Muslim Salika group against Christian militias. In a statement, the Chadian Foreign Ministry cited the recent accusations as a motivation for the withdrawal, noting, quote, "Despite the sacrifices we have made, Chad and Chadians have been targeted in a gratuitous and malicious campaign that blamed them all for the suffering in CAR." Experts have expressed concern about the consequences of the troop removal on peacekeeping efforts in the country. French diplomatic sources labeled Chad a, quote, key player in the mission, and United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon emphasized the need for countries to expand rather than reduce their troop presence in the region.
This is War News Radio. Since its inception, War News Radio has aimed to cover conflict and violence beyond the body count. In this spirit, War News Radio's Tyler Welsh sets out to investigate how the mainstream American media has sensationalized mass shootings and normalized urban gun violence, which takes thousands of lives every year in cities across the country. He talked to an old friend of the show, Jim McMillan, founder and editor of GunCrisis.org, about the media undercoverage of daily gun violence in Philadelphia and other urban centers.
29 on your Friday morning. We're going to interrupt programming. We've been telling you this morning there has been a shooting at a school in Newtown. This is the Sandy Hook Elementary School.
On December 14th, 2012, 20-year-old Adam Lanza walked into Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut and opened fire with a semi-automatic rifle, killing 27 people, including children, staff members, and himself. News of the event spread like wildfire through the media, attracting enormous amounts of attention. Similar tragic events have happened across the country, such as the 2012 movie theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, the Washington Navy Yard shooting last year, and others. The pattern of increased mass shootings is troubling. However, the apparent increase implies that gun violence occurred less frequently before. This is untrue. Cities like Chicago, Baltimore, Camden, Detroit, Miami, and others are all no strangers to gun violence. Even here in nearby Philadelphia, gun violence continues to plague the city's neighborhoods.
Well, 85% of the people killed in Philadelphia, typically around 85%, are killed with guns. So for the most part, it's a gun violence problem in our city.
That's Jim McMillan, founder and editor of the Gun Crisis Reporting Project in Philadelphia. GunCrisis.org is a solutions-oriented, independent, nonprofit journalism organization looking for the causes and solutions of gun violence in Philadelphia. To address the massive problem, cities have searched for a number of different potential solutions. Among the most successful is a model called Focused Deterrence. In the focused deterrence model, mediators bring drug dealers from the street to the negotiation table and explain the benefits of cooperating and the ramifications of noncompliance.
They point out that gun violence is going to be treated differently. And if you choose to move away from gun violence, we will provide more resources for you, job training, and even jobs in some cases. And if you continue shooting, there'll be new ramifications. We're going to clamp down like never before.
Jim points out that the offenders themselves are the ones who want peace most.
That nobody wants peace more than a soldier during a war. Nobody wants peace more than most of these guys on the corners that we've been blaming for the most part. And that they loathe the shooters as much as we do. They're working on drug corners out of necessity. There are no other jobs. They don't want to be killed. They don't want to have to carry weapons for their own safety. They don't like the deal very much. So by bringing them to the table, we've made a tremendous first step.
Where applied, focused deterrence has yielded astounding results.
Focused deterrence program is suggesting, I believe, about a 50% reduction where applied in part of Philadelphia, in South Philadelphia during 2013, and has seen similar results in other cities.
Another solution is the ceasefire public health model. Originally launched in Chicago, it has since been replicated in 17 cities, including Philadelphia.
And in the ceasefire model, they employ guys, what they call credible messengers, typically guys who've been very close to gun violence, who might have been shot, who might have shot somebody, who might have done some time, and from the same sorts of neighborhoods that are afflicted by gun violence. And they work, I think, with authorities to keep track of where there have been shootings, and then they go into those neighborhoods and they talk to they disrupt the retaliatory violence, and they try to disrupt the generational learning of violent behavior by helping people understand the ramifications of their actions.
The ceasefire public health model has also proven effective where applied.
For example, Ceasefire Boston was an innovation in criminology focusing on the most violent offenders, and it was very successful, led to a 60-something percent reduction in gun violence in Boston about 15 years ago.
Despite the successes of these interventions, legislators have focused on the supply side of the gun control debate, paying little attention to these effective models. McMillan comments on the merits of gun control legislation.
I have to be careful because I don't want to disparage gun control activists, but here's the truth. There are somewhere between 200 and 300 million guns in private hands in the U.S. already. So even if I could wave a magic wand and command gun control legislation personally, it's going to take a very long time to get the shooting under control.
McMillan makes clear that controlling the supply of firearms will not be sufficient to tackle the gun crisis in the near future. Ultimately, focused deterrence, ceasefire, public health, and gun control legislation, though different in their approaches, all recognize the importance of the larger patterns of urban gun violence rather than simply isolated incidents of mass shootings.
Year after year, mass shootings represent less than 1% of the shooting victims in America. So if we want to save more lives, I think we should focus more on urban violence.
McMillan attributes this media coverage gap to numerous factors, including racial prejudice.
Sometimes we perpetuate old old paradigms of reporting that no longer make any sense. I think we have reverberations of racism that make, I don't say they make us care less, but they make us report less.
This gap in media coverage is additionally worsened by the normalization of certain forms of urban gun violence.
In Philadelphia, we've had about 10,000 people shot and killed over the last 25 years. And that's about one per day. So there's another problem. So in news reporting, news value requires novelty, deviation from the norm. So if one person has been shot every day for 25 years, that guy who got shot today isn't news. It's not news unless he's a cop or a child or an innocent bystander or caught in the crossfire or meets some other measure of news value, or whether there was a great number of victims, or if the victim doesn't look like all the other victims.
He also points to sweeping changes in the media industry in the past few decades.
The traditional media industry is in an economic tailspin and has seen drastic contraction over the last decade to maybe a third of their previous resources. Social media, digital journalism, online journalism has shown that you get more traction, more sharing on happy stories than sad stories. So if you need to sustain your business by selling advertising through page views, water skiing squirrels pay much better than urban gun violence. So there's racism, there's economics, there's just failures to adapt, and there are very real shrinking resources.
Although recent mass shootings in the U.S. certainly merit attention, they also provide a facade that blankets the truth, that gun violence does not solely occur infrequently in deadly bursts, but rather on a daily basis. In many cities across the country, gun violence instills a sense of fear in a significant portion of Americans, yet it remains undercovered by the mass media. There isn't a simple solution to this problem of undercoverage. Indeed, perhaps the best thing we can do now is to promote substantive dialogue in order to raise awareness of the problem and work together in finding creative solutions. As Jim puts it,
so I don't propose a solution. I propose that we find one. I'm trying to build a hub where people can come together and communicate, not to tell them what to do.
For War News Radio, this is Tyler Welsh. Thank you.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Jay Clayton have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
We all need to take a nice, deep breath.
Revolution in Ukraine, civil war in Syria, mass protests in Venezuela, guerrilla warfare in South Sudan. We all really just need to get in touch with our inner light.
Or, at least, that's what Sergei Ryabkov, Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia, thinks is the solution to America's foreign policy problems.
Yep. According to The Guardian, Ryabkov was asked about the United States' response to Russia's annexation of Crimea. And he responded, quote, "What can we advise our American colleagues? They should get more fresh air, do yoga, eat healthily, maybe watch some sitcoms on television."
Clearly, the appropriate response to Russian President Vladimir Putin's deployment of 40,000 Russian troops to the eastern Ukrainian border is to all sit down and watch How I Met Your Mother.
Some nice downward dog will totally realign President Barack Obama's spiritual energy, and then he can start reacting like an adult.
Crunching on some celery sticks and taking a jog is, according to Ryabkov, quote, "better than getting themselves and others all worked up when they know very well that the train has already departed and that childish tantrums, tears, and hysterics will not help things."
Secretary of State John Kerry's dismay at Putin's blatant disregard of another country's sovereignty is just really immature. It's so silly to get all worked up about a military move that the United Nations has called illegal.
Illegal things happen all the time. Adults don't get worked up over every illegal thing that goes on in international relations. We'd never get anything done.
But, Jay, I can't take a deep breath. I can't calm down. Putin's gone too far.
How childish, Caroline.
No, I'm serious. He's seized Ukraine's spy dolphins.
Oh my god. Not the spy dolphins. That's just... Wait a second. Back up. Spy dolphins?
Yup. Believe it or not, first the Soviet Union, then the Ukrainian Navy, has been training combat dolphins and other marine mammals since the 1960s. They've taught them to locate mines, kill enemy frogmen, and even carry out suicide attacks on submarines.
They actually knife enemy frogmen with blades tied to their backs. Now there's an image that's going to haunt my nightmares.
But wait, there's more. Some of the spy dolphins have gone missing.
The plot thickens, and it could be foul play. Back in 2000, a Soviet ex-trainer sold at least 27 combat mammals, including walruses, sea lions, and a beluga whale, to Iran.
I thought it was bad enough that Iran was developing nuclear capabilities, but now we find out they have a knife-wielding walrus? Where will this arms race end?
How will I sleep at night, knowing that Iran could terrorize its enemies with a submarine-seeking whale?
And what will Putin do now that he has a fleet of adorable, squeaking killing machines at his disposal?
But never fear, citizens. The United States of America will protect you. Not only is the NSA listening to all your phone calls and radio broadcasts...
We hope you're enjoying the show, Mr. President.
But we have a way to combat the dolphin menace. Our own dolphin training program.
So we have a counter-killer dolphin killer dolphin program.
They do things like clear underwater mines from the Strait of Hormuz, though now they're starting to be replaced by drones.
We kind of hope anti-drone activists and PETA join forces on this one. Are these dolphins unionized?
Now, speaking of blatant thievery of other countries' cool programs...
North Korea is celebrating the one-year anniversary of its space program by giving it a new name and logo.
It's now the National Aerospace Development Administration, or NADA for short. If that sounds familiar to you, you're not alone.
Well, now that you mention it, it sounds a little like the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, as in NASA.
It sounds a lot like NASA.
Hilariously, it also spells the Spanish word nada, which means literally nothing.
Which maybe tells us something about North Korea's position in the space race.
Well, but okay, national and development aren't exactly unique words. This doesn't mean they copied all of NASA's PR.
I mean, it's not as if their logo is virtually identical to NASA's emblem or anything.
About that.
Oh God, seriously?
It's pretty much exactly the same image. Except for one crucial thing. The stars on NASA's logo form the Big Dipper.
Having the Great Bear on their emblem is a symbol of the way North Korean scientists are totally dedicated to, quote, glorifying Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il's Korea as a space power.
Dear leaders in space. Sounds like a cartoon I watched in the 90s.
Well, I thought space power reminded me more of Wrath of Kim. I mean, Khan.
Megalomaniac? Check. Genetically engineered superhuman? Still working on it.
Well, before we leave Kim Jong-un marooned for all eternity in the center of a dead planet...
That sounds surprisingly satisfying.
We need to have a talk about his hair.
Seriously, what's with that fade? Or the way it totally looks like a giant mustache sitting on top of his head when you look at it from the front?
While I couldn't agree more that it looks like a toupee made for a 6-year-old, that's not actually what I meant. Earlier this week, Free Radio Asia, a nonprofit news organization in DC, released a story that North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un mandated that all men in North Korea must sport the same hairstyle as their beloved leader.
It's genuinely disheartening to imagine all the citizens of Pyongyang walking around with Kim Jong-un's high and tight hairdo.
Are you surprised?
Not for an instant.
But the thing about this story is that it has no named sources.
So we can't be sure it's true.
But doesn't this tell us something ridiculous about Kim Jong-un anyway? If, as a tyrannical dictator, you get to the point where the entire world is willing to believe a story like this, doesn't that tell you that you're headed off the deep end?
Kim Jong-un has such a reputation for unadulterated, arbitrary looniness that major news organizations thought it was perfectly plausible that he ordered nearly 25 million people to get the same haircut.
Well, maybe there's something we're just not getting. Don't knock it until you try it.
That's uncomfortable.
Excellent summary. For Filibusted, I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Caroline Batten. As always, it's been a pleasure. At least for us.
This is War News Radio. After the February 2014 ousting of Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, the nation's future is still unclear. War News Radio's Allison Raybar speaks to Ukrainian citizens and expats about Ukraine's upcoming elections, internal tensions, and uneasy relationship with the Russian Federation.
When Eugene Belyakov was a cadet in the Ukrainian Police Academy in 1985, he knew exactly where his loyalty as a police lieutenant should lie.
I personally very well remember the oath we had to give as cadets, and that oath was to Ukrainian people, to protect Ukrainian people, but not thugs.
Eugene and his wife Julia now live in Australia, but Julia still lived in Ukraine in December 2013, watching with her family as protests exploded across Kyiv. The movement is now called Euromaidan, named after Kyiv's main square, Maidan Nezalezhnosti. When Prime Minister Mykola Azarov and President Viktor Yanukovych suspended a proposed free trade agreement with the European Union in November, peaceful protesters gathered in Maidan to support stronger ties with Europe. Police crackdowns led to bloody confrontations. Soon, opposition leaders demanded the resignation of Yanukovych's government and the release of political prisoners, and riots spread across the nation. On February 21, 2014, the Ukrainian parliament voted to hold new presidential elections, institute a plan of constitutional reform, and release Ukrainian political prisoners. But although Yanukovych is no longer in power, Ukraine's future is anything but clear. Russia has seized Crimea and its naval bases, and there are still protesters in Maidan. as Ukraine prepares for elections, Eugene still thinks his country is moving in the right direction. He is looking to presidential candidate Petro Poroshenko as a potential leader.
People are very, very, very hopeful, and they believe all of the new governments. They really awed by what Mr. Yatsenyuk does, because they understand that this brave young man, he's committed himself trying to rescue Ukraine from the dire economical and political crisis which Ukraine was brought by, you know, years of neglect and open robbery by Yanukovych and his team. Some people, they truly believe that if we all together, if we agree to stop giving bribes, because bribing to officials in Ukraine was a common practice at every level. So people, but you know, people, they really want to get away from all this mess, try to build an open and decent society.
But not everyone is convinced that the billionaire Poroshenko is the answer to Ukraine's troubles. Maharita Tulip, a journalist who volunteered as a psychological counselor for protesters at Maidan, thinks Poroshenko's business interests will sway his policy.
This is two big structures of the crime and of the money. So the President Yanukovych was the crime of our country, and now we have the money of our country.
Maharita thinks Maidan won't be empty for a long time.
Maidan protest will continue. And it's absolutely true, because people now can see the things they were standing for. Soon we will have our president election, and people can see the real candidate of the president, because they understand that all our authorities now built on the blood of the people which were standing on the Maidan.
And both Maharita and Eugene insist that there are still outside threats to Ukraine's fragile peace.
And we are also afraid of Yanukovych, which can come back to Ukraine and said that he is the real president of Ukraine. And with the help of Russia, he can do some extraordinary thing, even blood things.
Hopefully, it all resolves, but we need to be quite cognizant of our terrible neighbor, the Russian Federation, and the maniac Mr. Putla, as we call him.
With the Russian military firmly established in Crimea, Putin has 40,000 troops on the border of eastern Ukraine, and Eugene doesn't think Ukraine could withstand an armed conflict.
We know that Ukrainian army doesn't really exist. It's been destroyed, and it has been destroyed over 20 years. Russians, they're much stronger. They have better technology. They have more people. And watching at what happened in Georgia several years ago, we hate to have this happening in Ukraine.
Eugene thinks the solution is an economic one.
I'm really hoping that the US can put Russia to the list of prohibited countries next to Iran, Syria, North Korea, and other aggressive nations where they truly belong. And as soon as Russia loses all of the American cars, all of the American technology, all of the Microsoft or IBM products they use against the world, they will hang Putin within 3 months.
But Putin's political motives for annexing Crimea may outweigh economic considerations.
Crimea was the buffer zone between the Soviet Union and NATO. Yeah. And if Ukraine joins the EU, that buffer disappears. And Putin isn't left with a point of entry. He wants to put a military outpost right there.
That was Julia Belyakov, Eugene's wife. Julia, who lived in Kirovograd in central Ukraine until December 2013, explained through her husband that Putin's annexation of Crimea is also an ideological move against the United States. Russian media popular in Ukraine spreads anti-Western sentiment, encouraging political loyalty to Russia and portraying the European Union and the United States as enemies.
The propaganda works really hard to picture Americans as well as overall the Western society as the enemy of the state, simply because they don't want local people to embrace the democratic values most of the Western society live by. And if you have the common enemy, it's much easier to rule your own uneducated mob to achieve your own agenda or goals.
There are also internal divisions to consider. Eugene points to the political divide between Western and Eastern Ukraine, with Western Ukraine overwhelmingly supporting integration into the European Union, and Eastern Ukraine backing Yanukovych's loyalty to Russia. Western Ukrainians, he says, have much greater interaction with EU nations.
So those people, they have much better access to Western countries such as Poland, Czech Republic, and so on. So they see and they can compare the difference. And unfortunately, people who live in eastern parts of Ukraine are highly industrialized and totally covered by Russian TV channels. They really don't know life. Their wages are not high, so they don't go away much. So they may go to Crimea for summer holiday, but they're much closer to Russia and they more believe to what Russia say. And Russia really try to show themselves as a rich country who can afford anything, and military power is very important.
Maharida agrees that not enough unbiased information is reaching the mining families of eastern Ukraine. She says there are all kinds of misconceptions about the Euromaidan movement.
So that's why these miners just said that they are not agree with Maidan at all. They don't understand people which stand at Maidan. And moreover, these people are financed by the America and, I don't know, protest financed by the Europe and by the USA. For example, some people said that I am making money in Maidan, that USA bring me money, that's why I'm standing here.
Eugene is already planning to cast his absentee vote in Ukraine's upcoming presidential election on May 25th. He says he has faith in Poroshenko's economic prowess and in the fact that he doesn't have any accusations of corruption on his record. But Maharida, still in Kiev, is worried that Poroshenko won't be able to overcome Ukraine's own political tensions.
There is no political leader which can unite all part of Ukraine, because one leader is appropriate for east of Ukraine, one leader is in the north, because the attitude towards Maidan is different in different regions. So it's very important for Ukraine now to find the politician which can unite our country. If it's not happened so, the east of Ukraine, the same as the Crimea, will come back to Russia, and then the cruel things will happen.
Ukrainian protesters insist that their barricades in Maidan Nezalezhnosti will stand until the May elections are over. Meanwhile, Russia has increased economic pressure on Ukraine by raising natural gas prices, and Russia and the United States continue their tense negotiations over Putin's deployment of troops on the Ukrainian border. Whatever the outcome of the May election, replacing Yanukovych may not put Euromaidan to rest. For War News Radio, I'm Allison Raybar. Producer Caroline Batten contributed writing and reporting. Special thanks to Yana List for translating assistance.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Anissa Andrabi, Anita Desai, Sabrina Merold, Asma Nore, Nithya Swaminathan, Zoe Werbin, and Chloe Wittenberg. Our piece editors are Jay Clayton, Sadie Rittman, and Chloe Wittenberg. I'm Joelle Hajboutros.
And I'm Dylan Okabe-Jowdat. Until next time, thanks for listening.